Good evening. My name is Jeffrey Smith. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Ford Hall Forum. It is my privilege to welcome you here tonight. Tonight, Dr. Leonard Peikoff, leading interpreter of objectivism, will share with us his insights on the implications of contemporary domestic and international issues and trends. Before we begin, however, I'd like to make a few announcements regarding the Ford Hall Forum. The Ford Hall Forum was founded in 1908. It has provided a great service to Boston and to surrounding communities. Over the years, the forum has offered literally hundreds of audiences like yourself the opportunity to be educated with intriguing and informative speakers addressing crucial issues of the day. One of the glories of the Ford Hall Forum is that each meeting includes not only a presentation from the speaker, but also an opportunity for the audience to address questions directly to the speaker. The forum is in its 84th year now, and like many other organizations, it is struggling in this tough economy. The survival of the Ford Hall Forum depends upon you, our audience, and upon your contributions. We hope that you will join the Ford Hall Forum. For only $25, you can become a member of this valued organization. If you sign up this spring, your membership is good not only for the spring series, but also for the next fall. Membership in the Ford Hall Forum provides admission up to an hour before each lecture. Along with our regular mailings, members of the forum receive mailings and information regarding special events of the forum and discounts on our cassettes of each of our speakers' programs. I also want to mention that on Friday this year, on June 5th, the Ford Hall Forum will hold an Evening with the Pops at Symphony Hall. This fundraiser promises to be a fun-filled event, and I hope to see all of you there. To find out more about this program, would you please see our people at the information booth in the lobby? Finally, the final event of our spring season will be on Thursday, April 30th at the Old South Meeting House with former Speaker of the House Thomas P. O'Neill, Jr., historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, and novelist James Carroll addressing Mortal Friends, a conversation about Irish politics in Boston. And now, with regard to our speaker tonight. Dr. Peikoff knew and worked with Ayn Rand for over 30 years and is now her legal and undisputed intellectual heir. He is considered the leading interpreter of objectivist philosophy. Dr. Peikoff is the editor of numerous objectivist writings, including Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, The Early Ayn Rand, Selections from Her Unpublished Fiction, and The Voice of Reason. His own writings include The Ominous Parallels and his most recent work, published a few months ago, Objectivism, The Philosophy of Ayn Rand. Dr. Peikoff also teaches and lectures throughout the United States on objectivist philosophy, and this evening we are grateful that he returns to the Ford Hall Forum to discuss some notes about tomorrow, the future implications of certain present trends at home and abroad. I welcome Dr. Peikoff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone seems to agree that we live in a historic period, that we're on the threshold of a new world order. Intellectuals even define today's culture in terms of what it no longer is. It is post-industrial, post-modern, even post-rational. All of that is over, it seems. So what's next? What is our changing world changing into? I have no crystal ball, merely the New York Times. But occasionally I make a note about the nature and future implications of some event that it reports. And tonight, a few of these notes turned into English. The great political event of the decade is undoubtedly the collapse of communism and the end of the Cold War. After generations of communist disasters and atrocities, the whole evil empire fell. It seems in a stroke. Suddenly, the enemy was gone. The standard explanation is Gorbachev. Gorbachev introduced glasnost and perestroika. He thereby unleashed the spirit of freedom, but he couldn't put the genie back into the bottle, so the Eastern Empire broke up, and finally a last-ditch communist coup in Russia itself failed. Yes, it all happened. But why? Why did a Russian leader appear at this time doing the things he did? Gorbachev is no champion of individual rights or the free market. As he regularly tells people, he is still an avowed communist. I'm sorry, this is right between the two glasses and I can't see it. And even if he were somehow a pro-capitalist in wolf's clothing, how could he ever have convinced his comrades in the party, the KGB, and the Red Army to go along with his new policies? These kinds of people are not open to rational discussion. Their life consists of exercising and augmenting power. If they allow their power to be diminished, it is because they feel they have to allow it, that they have no choice. The standard newspaper line on this point is that the communists had to allow a measure of freedom because conditions were so awful in the USSR. The people were miserable, starving, and potentially rebellious. It is true that the people were starving and still are. But Russians have been starving since the communist revolution and semi-starving for centuries before that. People around the world are starving under every variety of collectivism. Earlier generations of communist leaders like Lenin and Stalin had an easy solution to this problem: mass murder of the starving. Murder in the millions, a scale of horror and terror such that no one could think of rebellion, no matter what his daily hunger pains. You cannot, however, have a totalitarian regime and a policy of mass murder unless the leaders feel that they have a moral sanction, which justifies their actions, answers their enemies around the world, and absolves themselves of blame. The moral sanction of political leaders is their ideology. That is what they live by and rule by. The reason communism collapsed is not that people were so poor, but that their leaders could no longer find a moral sanction for murder. The country lost the pretense at morality because the ideology of Marxism finally collapsed in the Soviet Union. I'd like to say that I owe this observation to Professor George Reisman. No one over there believed in Marxism anymore, and few even pretended to do so. It had become a joke to the intellectuals, an empty banality to the dictators, and a curse to the proletariat. Marxism died a protracted death in Russia. With each new generation, it lost more of the faith it needed from its subjects, until at last the critical point was reached. It became impotent to perform its political function. The monsters in charge no longer had any excuse, even in their own eyes. They lost the courage of their delusions. Thus, the final, timid, failed Russian coup. Now, I hold that Marxism had to collapse as it did. And this is not simply because it was bad, because some bad systems go on for centuries, but because of special reasons inherent in a philosophy like Marxism. Contrast here medieval Christianity, which tyrannized for 10 centuries over miserable, hungry subjects, but lasted, and still goes on more or less to this day. Whereas Marxism did not last 10 decades. I expect the few lone holdouts, such as China, to be relatively short-lived. What is the difference here? Marxism is a secularization of Christianity. It is Christianity, in other words, in essence, altruism and mysticism, or self-sacrifice and blind faith. It's that brought down from heaven, promising material rewards here on earth. The Christians said, don't think, obey God, suffer and sacrifice now, and then laugh eternally after you die. The more you suffer, the greater your joy in the next life. When communism entered the picture, by contrast, it denounced religion as pie in the sky, as the opiate of the people. It said, don't think, obey the state, sacrifice yourself, and we will make you rich and happy now, here, on earth. We will be the super engine of productivity. We will transform your life in material terms. The workers will soon revel in luxury after we expropriate the expropriators. The communists trumpeted all this while preaching the same essential philosophy as the Christians and practicing the same anti-productive policies. The Christians made no claim to perceivable results. They predicted and admired misery until death. The communists promised results here on earth but could not deliver. Meanwhile, their enemies in the West were growing ever richer and more prosperous. How long can you go on saying, soon, very soon now, you'll get rich and they will starve, when every day of every year, year after year, decade after decade, they themselves get poorer and the enemy gets richer? A medieval analogy to the situation would have to be something like this. If God, say, were to shun and curse virtuous Christians and periodically invited avowed devil worshippers up to heaven for a night of fun and games with him. And if the believing Christians saw this, they saw the celestial casinos on TV somehow. They saw that union with God was possible now and everyone was getting it but them, that would have been the death of Christianity, death by mass desertion. Of course, the Christians are safe on this count. God will never defy the dogma because there isn't any God. But the physical world does exist. It is what it is, and it would not cooperate with the communists. Hence their failure. The collapse, by the way, would have come much sooner if their regimes had not been propped up by billions in Western aid through the decades. To put the point in another way, you cannot unite mysticism with secularism, which is what the Marxists tried to do. That was their big innovation in philosophy. The dialectic process, which they advocated, the idea that the opposite of logic is the truth about reality, that reality is a torrent of ungraspable contradictions, ungraspable by Aristotelian reason, they tried to combine that form of mysticism with emphasis on sense perception, matter, and this world. That's their materialism. So the very name dialectic materialism itself indicates why it had to fail. It's a lethal contradiction. The two halves were incompatible, most especially in a world where, thanks to modern technology, even the lowest citizens of the USSR could hear over the radio about the gigantic material triumphs of the West. Let us look at the issue historically. Russia never had a Renaissance or an Enlightenment. In essence, it is still a medieval country in basic outlook, or even worse. At best, there were two competing groups active in Russian history. A minority of so-called Westernizers, impressed by Western developments and trying gingerly to import them into Russia, and a mass of Slavophiles, as they're called, who were anti-Western, pro-God, pro-faith, and pro-collectivist Mother Russia. Marxism tried to attract both groups by offering the essence of the Slavophile mentality under the veneer of being Western, worldly, and scientific. It was a thoroughly unbelievable construct, and the veneer simply peeled off. Now, there's a second lethal contradiction in Marxism, which made it impossible for it to last. And I refer to the crucial point made by Ayn Rand in her article on global Balkanization. And let me quote a paragraph from that. Quote, Marxism is an intellectual construct. It is false, but it is an abstract theory. And it is too abstract for the tribalist, concrete-bound, perceptual-level mentalities. It requires a significantly higher level of abstraction to grasp the reality of an international working class, a level beyond the power of a consciousness that understands its own village but has trouble treating the nearest town as fully real, unquote. In other words, collectivism appeals to and engenders a perceptual level mentality, the kind of person who feels at home only with the perceptually immediate, who identifies himself only with people who look like him, wear the same kind of clothes, dance the same dances, sing the same folk songs, speak the same language, eat the same foods, etc. A tribalist can identify with his race, his ethnicity, his nation, because in his mind these come down to people perceptually, just like him. To this mentality, the idea of a class, in other words, of men united only by their economic function, no matter how opposite their appearance, religion, clothing, music, ceremonies, etc., that whole idea is simply unreal. Wherever there is collectivism, there has to be racism and or nationalism, regardless of official ideology. Observe how intensely nationalistic were the appeals made to the Russians, even under communism. And observe how fierce are the nationalist sentiments and racial warfare that emerge in Eastern Europe the moment communism is lifted. Nationalism is collectivism, but with the nation. And in the end, this means the ethnic group or the race as the favored group, the one to be defended, extolled, and identified with. So please don't confuse nationalism with patriotism. The patriot says, my country is right, and therefore I love it. The nationalist says, I love my country right or wrong, because I belong to this group as against those aliens abroad. So the Marxist second lethal contradiction was to preach internationalism while counting on and breeding nationalism. They could not get the workers of the world to unite, only the ethnic Russians, the Georgians, the Serbians, etc. The result was their ideological death on a world scale, and when the pretense became obvious. If you want to know how profoundly the communists have stopped believing in their distinctive tenets, it was indicated in a recent New York Times story. An American reporter in Moscow, speaking with a 76-year-old language teacher, was asked about the condition of communism in the rest of the world. This was at a small rally of dedicated communists trying to defend the old system. Quote from the paper. She was very disappointed to hear that the British Communist Party had disappeared altogether and the American one nearly so. And then a quote from her. But tell me frankly, she said, you do have poor people in America. When told that of course there are poor people in America, she seemed very, very relieved, unquote. Now this kind of mentality, who doubts even the most elementary bromides of her faith, even the notion of the poverty and exploitation of the proletariat, that kind of mentality is no longer a historical factor. The communists lied so often, so fundamentally, and so verifiably, that no one, including the faithful, could keep the faith any longer. So Marxism collapsed, except, of course, in American universities. But what remains under its debris in Russia is the essence which was receptive to it in the first place, the essence which remains alive and unchallenged. And what essence do I mean? The two strongest forces in Russia now, all the papers declare, are religion and nationalism, often working in tandem. In other words, the forces are variants of mysticism, altruism, collectivism. A 70-year-old Russian lawyer who spent 12 years in the Soviet labor camps was asked by an American if the Russian political system has now changed fundamentally. Quote, something has changed, he said finally, but the foundation is still the same, and the foundation is the mentality of the people, which hasn't changed. unquote. How could it change when there is no one to teach the country any different ideas? People say, though I don't, that men don't need teachers or philosophers since they learn whatever they need from experience. What do you think the intellectuals and leaders over there have learned from the downfall of the USSR? I quote from an address by Václav Havel, president of Free Czechoslovakia and a favorite of American intellectuals. Communism, he says, was an extreme of modernism. And here I now quote, the modern era has been dominated by the culminating belief that the world and being as such is a wholly knowable system governed by a finite number of universal laws that men can grasp and rationally direct for their own benefit. This era, beginning with the Renaissance, was characterized by rapid advances in rational cognitive thinking, unquote. Well, of course, that's all true. Is this good in his view? No. It's the sin of pride and, quote, a cult of depersonalized objectivity, unquote. Quote from him, the end of communism is a serious warning to all mankind. It is a signal that the era of arrogant, absolutist reason is drawing to a close. Unquote. Instead of reason, he says, we must turn to guess what as our source of knowledge and guidance. Now, this is a direct quote. He didn't read Adams. Quote, the sphere of private whim, unquote. The sphere of private whim, which includes such elements as, quote, humility in the face of the mysterious order of being, and, quote, above all, trust in one's own subjectivity as one's principal link with the subjectivity of the world, unquote. Here is a man who had the courage under the communists to suffer imprisonment for his convictions, which consist, when he is freed and gains the ear of the world, of the idea that a whim comes above thought. Now combine the Havel subjectivist type with the religious Slavophile type, and you will know where Russia is now. Here's another Russian voice. I'm just taking a stab at the pronunciations here. Viktor Yerofeyev, a writer and literary critic. Quote, what was imported in Western Marxism will vanish, but communism will not disappear, inasmuch as the spirit of collectivism is at the heart of this nation. The nation will always say we rather than the Anglo-Saxon I, unquote. Have you read Anthem? Did he read Anthem? At the root of collectivism, Ayn Rand held, is the ethics of altruism, the morality of service, self-abnegation, self-sacrifice, which prepares men for a life of submissiveness and obedience. And altruism, of course, is the essential ethics of every world religion, and it was the official dream of communism. In the words of a New York Times writer, the dream was, quote, the creation of a Soviet new man imbued with selfless devotion to the common good, unquote. Now, the Times' attitude to this that emerges from the whole piece is, it was a noble ideal, a, quote, an irresistible utopian dream, unquote. But communism never achieved it, and probably no one ever can. But still, the writer goes on, the altruist ideal is the ideal. Quote, the Russian capacity for suffering and sacrifice, he says, whether in the war or in the endless lines today, is something that still awes foreigners, unquote. Notice the word awes, which means fearful admiration or veneration. Now, the writer continues that despite this incredible capacity for sacrifice, quote, the sloppiness and inefficiency of everyday life in Russia make an even stronger impression on visitors. The shoddiness of even the newest apartment block or hotel is shocking. Wreckage litters every yard. Cars come off the assembly lines half broken, unquote. Now, to this writer, the combination of sacrifice and shoddiness is shocking. He does not understand that you can create a totalitarian state with a mob of self-sacrificers, but not an automobile or a field of wheat. The ethics of altruism is the exact opposite of the requirements of production and therefore of life itself. A society with an incredible capacity to practice sacrifice has only one essence and future. Not only failure, but worse, anti-life. In other words, the deliberate pursuit and worship of failure. Now, is this merely objectivist propaganda on my part? Under the headline, East Bloc treading water in a sinkhole of lethargy. The New York Times quoted a Roman Catholic journalist who now serves in the Polish Senate. Quote, people think that if someone is successful in business, it must have been done immorally or illegally, he said. Sometimes I catch myself thinking about someone, you've been doing real well, there must be something wrong with you, unquote. Well, what could be wrong with doing well? Business is selfish. It counts on the profit motive. Private property is selfish. It belongs to the individual owner to be used for his own sake. And personal ambition, of course, is antisocial. It is antisocial in Russian eyes, not only because it is personal, but also because it leads to inequality among the citizens. The Russian mentality, the Times observes, is, quote, egalitarian in the extreme, unquote. Now, you might think the Times would approve of this, but Russia is too consistent in its egalitarianism, which disconcerts moderate Western intellectuals. Thus, while never renouncing egalitarianism as an ideal, a Times editorial criticizes some of its Eastern European manifestations, such as this statement from a Polish police chief, quote, whoever rises above the average level, we were spoon-fed under the communists, is automatically pulled back, torn down, until he suffers too. It doesn't matter if you are Polish or Gypsy or Ukrainian. If you somehow got rich over the years, you're going to inspire jealousy and resentment. And the editorial goes on, quote, Soviet citizens sometimes tell Westerners a profound joke. What is the meaning of envy? Well, in America, it's what a man feels when his neighbor gets a larger car than he has. To the Frenchman, it is what he feels when his neighbor gets a prettier mistress. In the Soviet Union, it is wishing your neighbor's cow would die. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is the awful and final meaning of altruism in any version, including the New York Times's. The insistence on equality means the equality of mutual hatred, of destruction, and finally of death. What then is the solution to Eastern Europe's problems? In everything I have read since the fall of communism, I've heard of only one individual anywhere who named clearly at least one important part of the solution. Listen to this. It's from a Spanish Barcelona newspaper's interview with Mikhail Fedotov, described on February the 22nd, I don't know if he's still alive today, as Russian Vice Minister of Information and Press. The context is the need for Russians, in his words, quote, to alter our social conscience and our motivations. And now here's a direct quote from him. We have been educated in the belief that money was evil and the rich were bad, that the ideal was to toil for the state and that he would look after you. What we have to do now is to inform the people and have them convinced that wealth is good, that one has to be selfish, We have to create a society of egoists capable of working hard and observing the law. This way we shall all profit. In Russia, we are 150 million invalids without the necessary consciousness to live a normal life. Unquote. Now, whom do you think this man has been reading? Who preaches the necessity of egoism, the virtue of selfishness, and the goodness of money? Obviously, directly or otherwise, this man heard something from Ayn Rand. Unfortunately, at least to my knowledge, he is a voice in the desert. If there were some other Russian intellectuals like him, if there were only a few hundred, say, who understood the philosophical case for egoism all the way down, then Russia would be saved, and so would we. Politics depends on ethics. So if you hear that Russia and the other Eastern European nations are struggling valiantly to embrace a free market and become capitalist countries, don't believe it. Some of them are trying, but none has a clue as to what to do or why. There was an instructive article in the Times recently titled, quote, "Why Eastern Europe is Going Nowhere," written by a research fellow at a Hungarian economics institute. Quote, "The ruling parties of Eastern Europe promised a smooth shift to a market economy. At the same time, the new governments have held on to control of 85 to 90% of national assets. Ministries of privatization were subordinated to the governments, leaving little room for genuine private initiatives. When privatization is allowed, it is used to buy grateful and loyal adherents." Now that's my interjection, would be, for example, here's a coal factory, now you and your gang have to vote for me for life. And then he concludes, quote, "In the former Soviet bloc, they have not established basic private property rights or rules," unquote. And that is all true. In other words, these countries are still statist at root and at heart. Their so-called free market has virtually nothing in common with the true free market, such as the United States had in the 1890s. If the United States itself, the bastion of semi-capitalism, is in the dreadful condition it is in, economically and politically, imagine what the Russian condition today is like. There can be no capitalism without the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, or their equivalent. Without a culture essentially devoted to reason and rights. That is why capitalism is dying in the United States and why they have not even any idea of it in Russia. Now, a note about tomorrow. In my judgment, Russia and Eastern Europe are headed inevitably toward a statist finale. Another orgy of dictatorship, this time most likely of a nationalist and or religious kind, which means closer to the Nazi variety than the communist. The difficulties of a transition from socialism to a free market would be gargantuan in any event. In a nation where the basic philosophy of socialism remains untouched, that transition is impossible. Now, some people over there understand this. Some Russians, this is a Los Angeles Times article, quote, "Some Russians, looking for a historical analogy to their present situation, refer to the months between February and November 1917, when a weak and ineffective provisional government held power, from the fall of the Tsar to the Bolshevik coup d'etat. Others point to Weimar Germany in the late 1920s and early 30s, before Hitler came to power," unquote. Both of these analogies, in my opinion, are valid. No one can predict with certainty the exact variant of irrationalism and dictatorship that will sooner or later engulf Russia. One can only say that given the nation's soul, its implicit philosophy, pre-communist and post-communist alike, there is no other possible end result. Now you can judge the liberals' demand that Americans disarm rapidly, since peace is here to stay. As one of these types puts it, history is now over, and Western liberalism has won the world. There are still nuclear weapons in Russia and in Ukraine, and there is still the same mindset which gave rise to the aggressive regime which built them. Given these facts, along with the nature of the rest of the world's governments, for example, in the Middle East, it is insanity. It is suicide to undermine America's power of self-defense by even one plane or bomb. But it is even worse to do so in order to pour a so-called peace dividend down the sewers of the welfare recipients. For the same reason, the proposal of Richard Nixon, to which Mr. Bush had once capitulated, the proposal to shower the Russians with billions of dollars in order to speed the development of capitalism, is absurd. Mr. Nixon is apparently going to remain a short-sighted, amoral pragmatist until his final breath. You cannot bribe a country into sharing your beliefs. Money is impotent against ideas. All that our billions will do is to give potential dictators over there more time to organize, because we will be keeping things going for them for another winter or two. Most of the billions, of course, will disappear down the bureaucratic mouths and probably into such still existing institutions as the Red Army and the KGB. Are you sure that these people are not planning for Russia what Hitler achieved for Germany? Do you know that World War III is impossible? I don't. Now, the evil I fear here, let me stress, is not Mr. Yeltsin, who seems to be a brave and honest man. The evil is Nixon Bush. The evil is bankrupting our own nation in order to feed potentially aggressive hordes who have no idea what to do and will not learn it from handouts. My own view is, don't help the Russians or attack them. Let them know we are militarily unbreached and that we will trade with them freely and invest private capital if and when they recognize man's rights and have something to trade. The best thing we could do now, of course, would be to send the right ideas over there and pound them into some Russian brains. But this no one in political power here can do, because anyone who can do it is thereby removed from political power. I'm often asked what Ayn Rand would say about the fall of communism. I think she would have agreed with me. She would have said, great, but you cannot install freedom simply by choice. That sounds paradoxical, but it's true. You cannot take a people ripe for dictatorship, kill off the present dictators, and then say, go, my friends, be free, because they will quickly clamor for a new dictator. That is the power of philosophy over men. Even if the Russians hate dictatorship, even if they sincerely, I underscore that, they sincerely want freedom, they cannot have it without its necessary intellectual base. And that base they neither have nor want, not that I can see. Now let me leap from Russia to the Orient. In other words, to my next topic, which is the current American-Japanese relationship. I think the overarching connection will become clear as I proceed. The American automobile industry is doing poorly. It is being beaten to pieces by the Japanese, and of course not only the auto industry, but also TV and other important parts of our manufacturing base. The superiority of many Japanese products to our own is something everyone knows about and experiences daily. Here is a tiny, relevant example from the Times, which can be multiplied hundreds and hundredsfold. A story mentions Mitsubishi in Japan and indicates that they buy certain car parts from the U.S. And I'll quote from the story. Chrysler, for example, supplies the Japanese plant by shipping transmissions to Nagoya for pickup trucks. With little prompting, though, I'm still quoting, quality control managers in Japan volunteer that there are frequent quality problems with the shipment. In some batches, 1% of the transmissions are defective. When we go back to the U.S. and raise the issue, one engineer said, the message comes back that they think 1% defect ratios are normal. Here in Japan, 1% is a big, big problem. Unquote. And now, one last quote from that article. The solution? Mitsubishi installs the Chrysler transmissions only in the trucks it ships back to Chrysler for sale in the U.S. Japanese models get a Japanese transmission. Now, do you see the difference here? Can you abstract the ruling principle? The principle of one side of the Japanese is that of the producer. I can make it good. I can do it. The principle of the other, our side, is that of the anti-effort mentality. I can get away with it. If you want to experience in perceptual terms what this difference across a thousand aspects and details adds up to, buy a GM car and then say a Toyota. I did just that. After years of owning and cursing a Pontiac, I bought a Lexus. Without exaggeration, I am not being paid to say this. I hereby state that going from a Pontiac to a Lexus is like going philosophically from Wittgenstein to Aristotle. I even feel some of the same respect now for my car as I do for Aristotle. Because the one value is ultimately an expression of the other, which the Pontiac surely wasn't. Our auto industry is obviously not moved by love of values. It has apparently taken its cue in this crisis from Atlas Shrugged. For example, Mr. Lee or Lido Iacocca, last January, before the Detroit Economic Club, stated, quote, I, for one, am fed up hearing from the Japanese. And I must say from some Americans, too, that all our problems are our own damn fault, unquote. Who does this remind you of? It's James Taggart and Atlas Shrugged saying, I couldn't help it. We are doing the best we can, Mr. Iacocca says in effect. And everything would be fine if the Japanese didn't produce such great cars and dump them in our country. His solution? Keep Japanese products or a significant portion out of our country. Not by virtue of us learning to produce better, but by government force, such as quota legislation and tariffs. The motto of this solution is buy America. Not because the product is good, but because it's American. I quote one advocate of this movement, Michael J. Shetcudi, I guess, manager of quality metal craft in the Detroit suburb of Livonia. Quote, my personal opinion is that we should stick with the Americans whether they are bad cars or good cars. It's our economic survival. I wouldn't care if the cars have cement tires on them, unquote. Now, this is not merely stupid. It is nationalism. Nationalism pure and simple. It is the same essential philosophy and tribal emotion that is tearing apart Eastern Europe and presaging dictatorship there. Tragically, as you must know, this man's attitude has many counterparts in the United States today. The most eloquent and horrifying example was the Chevrolet dealer who invited shoppers to destroy a Japanese truck with sledgehammers. Did you see the malice and glee on the sledge people's faces? Have you seen the same look on anti-Japanese politicians in Los Angeles or in Seattle, among many other places? This whole trend is mindless, racist, and statist. It acts to undermine the remnants of capitalism and leads to only one result, more government regulation and more government aid. In other words, more government. Who else is being counted on to knock down the villainous foreigners the villainous foreign intruders and help out the poor American moochers, such as Chrysler itself a few years back. A vocal group of Americans now resent the Japanese for being egoistic and for being honest and competent enough to fulfill their egoistic desires, not through robbery, but through superior productivity. If anyone is unclear about this subject, about the issue of our trade imbalance with Japan, or about so-called dumping, unfair trade, etc., I urge you to read an excellent article by Dr. Harry Binswanger, right here in the front row, titled Buy American is Un-American. And it appears in the April and August 1987 issues of the Objectivist Forum. And I'll try to give you the address in the question period. Among other things, Dr. Binswanger makes the point that free trade between two countries is to the benefit of both, that protectionism is harmful for everyone, and that the cause of our present serious lag behind the Japanese in many fields is one thing, one octopus with many more than eight tentacles, the government. American productivity is being strangled by American statism. And I quote Dr. Binswanger, just excerpts, quote, in certain respects, we are now less capitalist than other free world nations. Our antitrust laws are the world's harshest. Our regulatory agencies, such as the SEC, EPA, and OSHA, interfere with business to a far greater extent than do those of other nations. And the growth of our federal spending has been far faster than that of Germany and Japan. The actual cause of Japan's economic progress has been freedom, I'm still quoting, especially in the form of much lower taxes on savings. Over the past two decades, the Japanese saved about twice what Americans did, unquote. They saved and invested and grew. And where did our money go instead? Into government programs. In other words, into the opposite of production, into rewards for non-producers. The American Social Security system alone, Dr. Binswanger points out, is almost 20 times bigger than Japan's when it's adjusted for the respective GNPs. A government stranglehold on savings means a stranglehold on new investment. In other words, on new ventures. In other words, a de facto ban on serious competitors to the business establishment. It means the entrenchment of the Orrin Boyle type in America. Success by pull rather than by brain. And that is happening here on a scale appreciably worse than in Japan. I'm not saying the Japanese are perfect. They are a mixed economy, like all the freer nations today, not a capitalist one. And they have cultural ideals and economic practices both mystical and so and collectivist, which are worse than ours, which impede their progress and hold them back from the even greater heights they could reach. The Japanese have no philosophic basis for a business society, no culture of the Enlightenment built into their foundation. And without the U.S., they would not have become an economic power, nor could they last as one. All they had was the benefit of Americanism being foisted on them in practice a few times, especially in the aftermath of World War II. Whatever their flaws ideologically, the Japanese learned a tremendous economic lesson from the conquering Americans who occupied their country. They learned the importance of wealth and some of the conditions it requires, and they have made marvelous strides in carrying out what they learned. If you remember the nature of Japanese products during the 40s and 50s, when made in Japan was synonymous with junk that no one would take as a gift, and then you look at what that same country is turning out now, you must admire it. No matter how mixed their political, cultural situation is, you must, if you are human, admire achievement because it's achievement. Now, the Japanese are producers, but they are no more philosophical than other peoples. So they do not know how to identify the problems of American business, but they try to help. For example, They indict our educational system, and they point to the fading of the work ethic here. Now, the trouble with these charges is not that they are false, they are true, but that they do not go to the roots of our problem. Why is our education so bad compared to the Japanese? Because even the dedicated rote learning of their worst schools is superior to zero. And by zero, I mean John Dewey. In other words, progressive education. In other words, the formal commitment to anti-cognition in the schools by employing teachers who refuse to teach because they say there are no facts anyway, and the student must learn to feel his own subjectivity or else go and take a poll of his peers. How could creatures educated in this approach qualify as workers in an industrial society? They can't and they aren't. Meanwhile, the same governmental mentality that has a coercive monopoly on the public schools has been sapping the work ethic even more directly. It sabotages labor, for instance, through 1,000 anti-work work rules forced on management by the unions, who stay in power only through federal legislation. And it sabotages management in that our system specializes in turning out ore and boils. Now, of course, not all our industrialists are boils, but too many are turning that way. The Japanese are right in their charges, but neither they nor the U.S. sees the fundamental cause. That cause lies not in the schools or the factories, but in the universities. In other words, in philosophy. Without knowing the cause, no one can effect a cure. Now, in conclusion this evening, let me address the question, what can any person do about it all? For years, you've heard me come here and say, it's too soon for political action. We need philosophical education first. Well, that's still true, but I am not going to repeat it tonight. Instead, in an unusual move, I am going to come out for political action. For the first time, I am urging you to vote in November. I think it might make a difference if you do it the right way. And by the right way here, I mean the following, which I'll quickly elaborate. Vote Democratic for the presidency. Vote for any Democrat nominated by his party for the presidency. Period. In other words, do the most possible to get George Bush out of the White House. The record of George Bush is truly disgraceful. It is filled with evasions, flip-flops, compromises, and outright surrenders to evil, foreign and domestic. And you know it all as well as I do. Taxes, read my lips. Civil rights, he endorses new legal burdens on employers after swearing to veto such a bill. Trade with Japan, he was Orrin Boyle's escort and chauffeur to Japan and is urging the Japanese to cut their productivity. Russia, he's intent on giving away a fortune. Israel, he is to that country the most hostile American president ever. The Gulf War was the only time in history that I know of where a country's leader was so uncertain that he took months to gain approval for a war by a vote from all the nations on earth, and even then, still feeling guilty, quit that war 24 hours early and thereby lost everything we were allegedly fighting for. Posing as a conservative, Mr. Bush picks only the worst of the conservative views, such as anti-abortion and legislation against obscenity. The symbol of his attitude to free speech is the Salman Rushdie case. Rushdie, as you must know, the victim of the Ayatollah Khomeini's death decree, risked his life recently to come out of hiding to the United States and beg in the name of the principle of free speech for Americans to stand by him. He knew, as everyone does, that a word from the administration to Iran, a word backed by the real threat of action would end his nightmare and reaffirm the right of men to think unmolested by brute violence and maniacal religions. What reception did he get from the administration? Marlon Fitzwater, who is the White House spokesman, said, and I'm quoting from the Times, he, quote, blithely dismissed Mr. Rushdie's visit to Washington as nothing more than an author on a publicity swing, quote, doing book tours and things that authors do, unquote. Can you conceive an evasion of this dimension? Margaret Tutwiler, the names could have come from Atlas, huh? The State Department spokeswoman said that no senior officials of the United States would meet with Mr. Rushdie because, quote, such a thing could and possibly might be misinterpreted, unquote. By whom? Well, presumably by the Iranians. Well, how would they misinterpret? They'd think Bush was going to take a stand, defend an individual's liberty, do something. And the Bush administration is anxious to show that it can be counted on by thugs around the world to look the other way every time. Now, in my youth, I used to think that the liberal Republicans, like Nelson Rockefeller, were the worst bunch in politics. I don't think that anymore. George Bush is the worst of the liberals combined with the worst of the conservatives. And yet he is regarded by many people as a true conservative, and all his offenses become in their mind charges against capitalism, which will taint it for decades to come. This man must be removed from office, in my opinion, if there's to be hope for the future. Let me quote here from an unknown 34-year-old lawyer in New Hampshire, interviewed by the Times as he left the polling booth on primary day last February. Quote, I have just never been more confused. I don't even want to say who I voted for because my thinking was so unclear. The only thing I know is that President Bush has done an absolutely abysmal job and he cannot continue. What I tried to do was figure out the best way of helping him lose, unquote. And I say amen. That is precisely my stand. Now, the best way of making him lose is not to simply refrain from voting, but to vote for the Democrat. When you Republicans, as I assume most of you here are, when you refrain from voting, you say, in effect, it makes no difference to me who wins. So your non-vote, in effect, counts once. It's one less for Bush. But if you vote for his opponent, your vote counts twice. He doesn't get it, so it's one less for him, and his opponent does, so it's one more for him. This way, you positively help to defeat the incumbent. Now, it's not enough to vote for any non-Bush candidate. You have to vote for the man who seems to have the best chance to actually win the election. And that eliminates voting for splinter candidates who have no chance of winning, such as Ross Perot or Pat Buchanan. Now, besides, neither of these men are what the country needs, and neither would do any good. If you think I'm wrong in this, please ask me about it in the question period. To me, there is nothing to do but vote for the Democratic nominee this year, whoever it is. Clinton, it looks like, or Tsongas, or someone worse, even if it ends up being Jerry Brown, the Reverend Jackson, or Mario Cuomo. Now, you will object that such people would be even worse than Bush. I don't think so. Because not one of the Democrats is popular. And besides, whatever they try to get away with, there will once again be some opposition in Congress. There will be Republicans who have seen the defeat of Bush, who know they cannot count on the conservatives in the country to back them no matter what they do, and who, as opposition members, have the right and the duty to rebel, play partisan politics, scream their heads off, and slow the White House down. Whereas if Bush gets in again, he will propose the same things in a little more moderate form as the worst of the Democrats, and on top of that, he will have no real opposition. The Republicans risk their careers if they fight too hard against a president from their own party. In effect, my analysis is like this. Republicans out of power at this juncture are better for the country than Republicans in power. In power, they will promote the growth of statism. Out of power, they may promote governmental paralysis, which we desperately need. And there's another point here. Several economists are expecting some kind of economic disaster in the next years, whether a depression or runaway inflation or who knows what. As a lifelong Republican, I would be happy to see this disaster strike when the Democrats are in the White House. They richly deserve it, and it would be an albatross around their party's neck for decades, just as the 29 Depression was around the neck of the Republicans. The Republicans have now sunk to their lowest point ever, and it is crucial to get them back onto a semi-plausible path by letting them see that they can't get away with the leadership they are now offering. Perhaps, if Bush is defeated, they will learn from it and offer us someone better in 1996. But please don't ask me who it should be. I have never heard of the man so far. Let me say that what I have been telling you about the election is Peikoff's recommendation, not Ayn Rand's or objectivism's. A philosophy does not back candidates and does not vote. There can be legitimate differences among people of the same philosophy in regard to political tactics and strategy. So please don't be unduly influenced by my point of view. Think it over and judge independently. I have merely told you how I propose to vote in November, if I can. I know that I can vote for Clinton or Tsongas, bad as they are. But if Jerry Brown or his equivalent is on the ballot, I admit it will be hard. To be perfectly honest, I am not sure that I can physically bring myself to do it in the voting booth. But if my arm can rise to pull the lever, I will do it. Now, originally I intended to end my talk here, but for some reason Harry Binswanger thought it should have a happier ending. And he helped me to think of it, so let me end on a brighter note. Communism has collapsed, and there is less immediate threat of nuclear confrontation. We are now the acknowledged one superpower, if only we keep it that way. As to the trade issue, the American public, thankfully, is not falling for the Buy American campaign so far. It is buying Japanese and loving it. And as to the election, the popular consensus is not enthusiasm for anyone, as I've indicated, but alienation and disgust. The attitude of people is a plague on all your houses, Democrat and Republican, Congress and the administration alike. The majority of people state in poll after poll that they wish there was another candidate to vote for. In other words, Americans, as against politicians and professors, still exist. They're still there. They can still hear us if we keep on addressing them clearly and loudly. I'm glad one person agrees. And I think we are starting to get somewhere. Objectivism is a small movement, but it is growing, especially in quality. Ayn Rand's books continue to sell heavily, about 300,000 to 400,000 a year in paperback alone in the United States. According to a recent Library of Congress survey of readers, this is a widely publicized survey, Atlas Shrugged ranks second only to the Bible as this country's most influential book. In addition, the Ayn Rand Institute is doing outstanding work in spreading the ideas and reaching the young generation. In my opinion, There are more knowledgeable objectivist intellectuals, knowledgeable about objectivism, than I've ever seen before. And finally, to be fair to myself here, even if this is self-complimentary, I think that in the long run, my own book on objectivism will have a real and positive effect, although I have no idea of the time involved. Thank you. So I want to close with a note of hope about tomorrow by reading the very final passage of my book. Quote, "All things excellent," said Spinoza, "are as difficult as they are rare," unquote. Since human values are not automatic, his statement is undeniable. In another respect, however, and this is Ayn Rand's unique perspective, the task ahead is not difficult. To save the world is the simplest thing in the world. All one has to do is think. Thank you. Thank you very much.
As you know, this is the opportunity for you, the audience, to participate and to present questions to our speaker. If you'll go to the microphones that are set up on the right and the left, I will call alternatively from the right, if you would.
Dr. Peacock?
Are we on? Dr. Peacock, thank you for your book.
You're very welcome. Thank you for thanking me.
My question regards to the concepts of evil and immoral. Is it possible for an action to be evil and not immoral, or vice versa, and what is the precise relationship between the concepts?
Well, you're making a distinction, you're asking for a distinction between evil and immoral, and that is really more of a linguistic than a philosophic question. In a broad sense, you either act as morality requires, or you go against what morality requires. And the third possibility is you simply mistakenly act without being evasive in the process. Your action is wrong, but you are still moral. But if you're talking about an action which is volitionally against morality, it is immoral, and in many contexts, the same thing as evil, because its essence is that of evil. In other contexts, however, evil is a more extreme on a continuum. So you would say, for instance, Adolf Hitler was evil for what he did. But if you lie to your boss about why you went to work, or didn't go to work, that's an immoral act, but I wouldn't say you are evil because of it. So there's a quality of extreme degree to evil in some kind.
Since your talk was about the future, I'll ask a question concerning the future generation. I heard that you recently taught objectivism to first graders. Now, I would have liked to ask you to elaborate on teaching objectivism to first graders, but I'll ask something else.
No, I'm not following you. Is this all a preamble to the...
Yeah, that's okay. Just a preamble. Now the question. Suppose you have parents who are of mixed premises or highly Kantian, but they still have a child whom they love very much. How would you sell objectivism to them? Is it possible to sell objectivism to such people, and how would you do it?
Well, you didn't need the child, because the question amounts to, suppose there are people who are mixed in their ideas, are essentially corrupt like Kantian in their ideas, can you sell objectivism to them? Is it possible, and how?
I needed the child because I say, suppose they value the child as an... Even though they're Kantian, they value a child.
Yes, I'm sure they value the child and they value survival, but the fact is that their ideas are going against both and are crippling the child in the process. Now, if you could show them in their own terms that they are hurting their child, that would, of course, be very helpful, but you can't do that. You might do that in one out of, 100,000 cases. But normally, if a person is as bad as you describe intellectually, they are evasive, they're not open to argument, You can't persuade them, and they will ascribe their child's delinquency to the capitalist system or violence on television or, you know, one of the standard things, and you simply won't get anywhere. It is not possible to convert everybody. In fact, I'll go further. It's not possible to convert the overwhelming majority of people, mostly because they don't even regard philosophy as being within their prerogative. They take philosophic views implicitly as self-evident. And they just think that anything that goes against what they feel, it just doesn't make any sense, and they're helpless even to think about it. And then there's the more evil ones are the ones who are being deliberately dishonest, and those, of course, there's no way to penetrate. So the only hope of converting people, aside from an occasional adult who retained, you know, after his education, a degree of health, is with the younger generation. Now, if you want to convert people or spread ideas, you have to do it when you get them young enough. And can I take 1 minute to tell a story here? I say young. I've come down in my years. I had a delightful experience last month, the most enjoyable teaching experience I ever had. I was asked by my daughter's teacher, she's in grade one, and she has a mixed grade one and grade two class, if I would come and deliver a lecture to the class, they're six and seven, on philosophy. So I took it as a challenge, and I asked her for the time limits, and she said they can sit still for about 8 minutes. So I prepared an 8-minute talk, but actually I did not have to restrict myself to 8 minutes, because they sat there asking questions for 40 minutes. And in that time, I was able to cover the essence of philosophy, what it means to have a view of the universe, you know, as against just a particular thing, and what the essential difference is between Plato and Aristotle. And the teacher gave these kids as an assignment to write me a letter telling them what they had learned and put them all together in a book which they bound and gave to me, and they got the right answer. Much better than freshmen and sophomores. So I went away from that experience thinking maybe I had lived my whole life wrong and I should start teaching elementary school. But that is apropos of, if you want to teach people, I'm not really seriously saying you take six-year-olds, because they can't judge at that point. But the younger, the better. And conversely, the older, the more hopeless.
Dr. Peikoff, I agree with you that adopting a protectionist system in this country is not the proper response to the Japanese building a better product. But my question for you, sir, is, how do we respond to Japanese protectionism? What is the appropriate American response?
The appropriate American response to any other country's protectionism is not protectionism here, which merely cripples our own industry and perpetuates the failures, but complete free trade. And by that means, we build up the strongest possible American industry, and it ends up that they are hurting their side and we are benefiting from the free influx of better products and specializing in, at the same time, in where our own strengths lie. So it's ridiculous to say that if one country is harming itself by giving us superior goods cheaper than it costs them, which is what the argument amounts to, we should do the same thing to ourselves. That is absurd. Let the other governments have any irrational policy they want. Freedom will beat them every time. And as soon as they see that, they themselves will start clamoring for the great American Pontiacs.
Dr. Peikoff, would you care to comment on the following candidates for president in the following parties and years? And
I mean, I'd
only three. Only three.
All right, who are they?
Ross Perot, 92, yeah. Republican or independent.
Yeah.
H. Norman Schwarzkopf, 96. Norman Schwarzkopf.
Yeah. The 96. War.
That's correct. Yeah. Right, 92, Republican or Democrat, 96, right. And Pete DuPont, governor, ex-governor of Delaware, in 96,
Pete,
Republican.
Pete DuPont?
Pete DuPont, yeah. That's correct.
Well, I have very little to say about the last two. I didn't know that Schwarzkopf is running. I do not know anything about his policies or views. The little I could make out from the war coverage and from one apparent slip that he made in a press conference, he was a good commander in the field, and he did not like Bush's withdrawal at the time that he did. But he is, the only thing I can say about him that I know as a negative is he is extremely adroit on television, and that makes me suspicious. But it's too much too early to have an opinion. I don't have any idea what he stands for. Now, Pete Williams, DuPont, excuse me, is, I don't know where I got that. I also have heard occasional, I guess you would call them ideas, on certain specific issues, but they were very concrete bound. There was no passion or integration to them. He was not a personality, and he didn't have any effect on his audience or on me, as far as I could see. And you kind of nodded and said, yeah, he said some good things. I wonder who will vote for president. But he just took himself out by not being, let's use that horrible word, not being philosophically charismatic enough. In other words, he didn't have a central idea. Now, Perot, so far, on the basis of limited evidence, I do not like. He, as far as I can see, giving him the benefit of the doubt, believes that what this country needs is an honest and efficient president, and that that would solve our problems. Now, if it were true that that's what we needed, I'm sure he would be able to provide it, at least judging from his business success, although other people have told me that he made most of his money by deals with the government, but I haven't investigated that. He has made billions. He did some heroic things in his life about saving hostages and so on. So he's definitely courageous. He doesn't need this job for the money. He's definitely, whatever his motive, I think he says what he believes. But I do not think that honesty and efficiency will have any effect, because you got to have ideas. Which ideas are you honestly going to implement? Now, he says he's going to make it a true democracy, put a sort of, you know, 1984-like hookup in every home, and then the citizens can vote directly. So when the question comes up, well, should we have socialized medicine, they'll just take a vote, you see. And that way we'll do what the people want. Can you imagine what is going to be the biggest job in Washington if we adopt his setup? It's not going to be the president. It's going to be the person who words the poll, you know. Because that will dictate the results. Every state and every little group will have its own television station representing the public as a whole, it claims, and telling Mr. Perot what the nation really wants. That's what Congress is supposed to be for, that the people get together, elect representatives who then inform the president what the people want. But he's saying, in effect, it doesn't work. We're going to go directly to the people. That means mob rule on every question, even if technologically you could do it. Can you imagine how the American public would vote out of context on any question? Do you believe in the right to property? Yes. Should we raise income taxes so that everyone should have medical insurance? Yes. Do you believe in freedom of employers? Yes. Has everyone got a right to a job? Yes. I mean, you could get a ringing vote for everything that way. What I most dislike about Mr. Perot is that he does not commit himself to anything that I could see. I think he once came out for abortion and then a little later moderated his stand. And he has commentators baffled because conservatives love him, liberals love him, moderates, independents, everybody loves him. But as far as I can make out, he is loved because nobody has any idea what he would do when he got in. He's loved in his negative capacity of being a rich non-Bush. But until and unless, I would vote for him under two conditions. If he came out with a principled pro-capitalist ideology, and if there was one chance in 10,000 that he could get elected. At present, neither of those is remotely true. So I think it's a waste of your vote and an actual harm to the country to take away votes from the only conceivable, at now present, person who could beat Bush and throw down some splinter group. And I'm speaking in April 26th, 1992 at 8:25 p.m. Eastern Time. So who knows, you know, whether any of this will be applicable tomorrow.
Now that in this country the socialist movement seems to have kind of fizzled, nearly done, seems like the environmentalist movement is now what's taking its place. What do you see the future of that movement being?
I wish I knew. I agree with you that socialism has now got such a terrible black eye around the world from the failure throughout Europe and the communist world, that it's going to take a long time to come back in that form. And I also agree with you that the greatest current threat, not only to capitalism but to civilization, is no longer on the level of socialism. It is the environmentalist movement in all of its branches, ecology and, you know, the pro-spotted owl and the pro-rainforest and the whole gamut of garbage that we are showered with every moment of every day. Now that, I think, is truly a threat to the future of the country, because it is duping people into the belief, again, that the only solution is governmental power to curb the ruthless businessmen and the polluters and so on. It is simply a different route to the same end that socialism was a route to. And it will lead to the same stagnation and to even worse pollution. If we want even a laboratory test case, if pollution is the issue, do you know what it's like in Eastern Europe as against even in Los Angeles smog? I mean, they wouldn't even know how to breathe if they came over here. The air is too clean in the most polluted parts. So you wanted me to know the future of environmentalism. Will it succeed? I don't know. What I find very disheartening is my daughter comes home and she spouts these things, and she has no idea, you know, that she's spouting ideology. Her teacher tells her you should be nice to trees. You know, how could a 6 or 7 year old think that that's wrong? The kids are brainwashed throughout the country on such a level that by the time they reach college, it's simply not conceivable. Ecology to them is an axiom, like, you know, if equals be added to equals, the results are equals. It's just self-evident. You have to be a lunatic not to believe in it. Now, I've seen this take place in the last 20 years. And, of course, that's what progressive education is for, to empty the slate and make everyone a tabula rasa so you can then pour in whatever content you want. And that's what they're pouring in now. I don't know. I don't know. There is opposition to environmentalism among some scientists who occasionally get heard. Once in a while, you hear a fact that slips out through the press censorship, you know, such as the tremendous success of nuclear power in France. But then you never hear about it again. They push it back under the covers. What is going to happen on that, I truly can't predict. But I am not hopeful as of this moment. And I certainly agree with you that if you want to concentrate on any one current evil, that's the one.
Dr. Peikoff, you raised an interesting question in your lecture about the possibility of a nation like the Soviet, like former Soviet Union, ever embracing capitalism, considering the breadth of its current intellectual decay and the extent to which
it embraced. Decay, because they never got, you know, to be right.
Okay, void or whatever you want to use. At any rate, there is, you know, there's still primarily widespread epistemologically, basically mystical view of the universe in the Soviet Union. But wasn't this also true in Japan in 1945? And in two generations, you mentioned a few moments later, they were outstripping the West. Is there therefore not for optimism?
I think there are two differences. I'm not an expert in Japanese versus American versus Russian culture. But from the little that I know, however mystical the Japanese were, they never came near to what I was referring to as a Slavophile mentality. They were not that thoroughly eaten away. I don't think any of the Oriental countries that I know of, including China, is as bad as, for instance, Russia or India, in terms of their absolute removal from reality, an absolute commitment to mysticism and otherworldliness. The other big thing is that the Japanese were invaded, were conquered, and were ruled by MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, so that the system was forced in. And, you know, they were utterly traumatized by the loss of the war, so that the previous regime was completely discredited. But instead of what happened in Weimar Germany after World War II, that a dictator cashed in, an agent of freedom cashed in. And so they went a completely different direction. So they owe their prosperity right now to America, not to Americans today, but to the Constitution, which was still directing the American occupation in the 40s. Now, how long that can go on when America is abandoning its heritage, I don't know.
I've heard it said that free will is limited, and I was wondering in what respect.
Free will is limited in 1,000, in 100,000 respects. There's 100,000, many more than that, things that I cannot will to do. I can't jump to the moon. I can't make it 9 o'clock now. I can't make there enough time to answer 40 more questions in the next 30 seconds. I mean, it's just everything in the world is out of my power. The only power I have as a free choice being is one choice. This is the objective view. To use your mind or not, to focus your intelligence or not, to think or not, that's all. Thereafter, you have to take the consequences of your conclusions, your actions, and so on, and you can't use your free will to get around the laws of reality. You have only one choice, and that's the whole limitation. It consists your choice of one thing, to face reality or not, and therefore everything else is determined. Are we out?
Well, I want to take...
Well, whatever you say.
Two or three more questions. The three people that were standing...
Okay.
Sorry, sir, there won't be time for the third on the left.
Okay.
I appreciated your comments very much on the fall of communism in the former Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc. Can you comment on the prognosis for the fall of communism in American universities?
I have nothing, not even a hint of a positive glimmer of hope for American universities, because I can't think of any force that could dislodge them. Since they set the ideological tone, they simply dismiss any ideas that are not theirs. But they have an economic, governmental stranglehold, directly or indirectly, on all higher education, so there's no way of starting another outlet. So there's no way to get the ideas in circulation past the barriers of the entrenched professorate. Now, if we could abolish tenure, that would be a magnificent beginning. If we could abolish aid to education, that would be fabulous. But as it stands right now, they have absolute, unbreachable power over the power that controls the future. And how that could be taken away from them short of a revolution, which includes killing in the streets. And I don't foresee that, at least not soon. I don't know. I have no idea how the situation could become better. You don't have to applaud that. Yes. Wait, on your side. Yeah.
I'm going to be unfair and ask two questions. First, is there any effort to send objectivist material to Russia and Eastern Europe?
Oh, yes.
Where can people send money?
The Ayn Rand Institute has... now, let me try to remember. They have already sent objectivist material to Poland and authorized translations into Polish of various things, and they're also doing it to Russia. The Institute has brought out a whole booklet of various of Ayn Rand's writings, selected to be, you know, a sort of a primer for Russians, and I believe that is already has been translated and is being sent to Russia. So there is, so to speak, an active Eastern European wing of the Institute. Yeah.
And more specific, with respect to America and the election this fall, isn't there a serious danger that the Republicans might interpret a defeat as, in fact, a call to become more liberal and more statist, that, okay, we have to go the Democratic route to get the vote?
There's a danger, I have to grant you, that the Republicans could interpret anything as anything. Because interpretation is not their strong suit. But I still say you have to go by what you hope is the obvious message. You know, I mean, all of these people are screaming against Bush for all of the liberal things he did, from taxes on up. So, I mean, even Clinton is trying to come across, you know, he is a cross between JFK and Carter. And he is trying to come across as being, you know, moderate and right-wing, and just once in a while he slips out, you know, a few things. If they lose and then come to the conclusion it's because Bush is too liberal, then I would say, if that's the way the country works, resign. Never vote again because it's hope. But I don't think that.
Dr. Peikoff, since it's now okay for objectivists to engage in public intellectual discourse with some libertarians, such as talk show host David Brudnoy, as you stated on your show Friday night, how can a rational student of objectivism determine which libertarians are okay to talk with?
Well, I think that is a very unfriendly question. And I will give an answer to the question you're asking, because I won't answer the one that you purport to be asking. I do not debate libertarians, and I do not endorse debating libertarians, nor would I ever do it myself, nor have I done it myself from the day I discovered the meaning of libertarianism. Now, David Brudnoy, number one, I was not debating him. I was invited on his show, and I've been on it many times. He is a perfectly cordial and courteous host whose entire goal is to let me speak to his audience, which consists of 3 million people in 38 states and 6 Canadian provinces. He in no way debates or intrudes his views on me. In addition, after the question that came across the air, I said to him in the intermission there that I was surprised I'd never heard him referred to as a libertarian. He says, I said, are you a libertarian, like with a capital L in the movement? He said, oh no, I'm, quote, libertarian hyphen conservative hyphen pro-capitalist hyphen a little objectivist hyphen. In other words, he's using libertarian insofar, this is my understanding anyway of his position, as simply a very generalized term for the overall right-wing viewpoint. Now, I myself wouldn't use the word that way, so we have a linguistic disagreement. That is not the same thing as saying I appeared on a libertarian show or sanctioned libertarianism or debated with them. I think it is just simply unfair to raise that question, and I don't want to debate it any further. So on that cheerful note, thank you very much.